Welcome back to On the Case, the podcast. I'm Paula Zahn, and thanks for joining us for episode 16, Heartbreak in the Heartland. Tonight, we're on the case in Salina, Kansas, about 3 hours west of Kansas City. The quiet Midwestern town became the shocking setting for a horrifying triple homicide. The details of this unthinkable crime would destroy a family and leave a community heartbroken. Sunday, July 21st, 1996. Kathy Melander had been looking forward to a family reunion at her mother's house. Her sister Carol and a very special guest, her great-nephew Christopher, were in town visiting. But as she drove over, her excitement was mixed with concern. She hadn't been able to get in touch with them all morning. Kathy Melander.
We were planned on going to lunch, so I started calling about 9:15, and nobody answered. By the time I called at noon and they still hadn't answered, then I thought something was wrong, and they would have called.
When Kathy pulled into her mother's driveway, she saw nothing that eased her fear.
I just looked in, peeked in the window, and I saw that the garage door was down. The door into the house was wide open. And the car was gone. I have no idea why I didn't go in the house. Something told me not to go in.
Instead, Kathy ran to a neighbor's house to call for help.
The next door neighbor was a lady I knew well, and asked her to call the police.
Salina police arrived within minutes.
Two officers responded. No one would answer the door, so the officers entered into the residence to see what they could find.
An officer emerged just moments later.
He came out, and I could tell by the look on his face that there was something really wrong. He said, "You don't want to go in there."
The officer gave Kathy devastating news. Her mother, 80-year-old Dolores McKim, her sister, 56-year-old Carol Abercrombie, and her great-nephew, 5-year-old Christopher Abercrombie, were all dead.
They didn't say anything about what had happened, why they weren't alive.
Uniformed police secured the scene. Special Agent Ron Hagen of the Kansas Bureau of Investigation entered the home looking for clues.
Door was already open. And as you're going down the hall, it's really quiet. And to the right, I saw Dolores.
The brutality of the crime stunned the seasoned investigator.
She was beat to death.
Dolores was in her pajamas. It appeared that the vicious attack had taken place sometime after all three victims had gone to bed on Saturday night. Detectives theorized that the 80-year-old had heard an intruder enter her home and had gotten up to investigate.
There's no doubt in my mind that she confronted him and then he struck her. I think Dolores went down pretty fast. And I think that time, then Carol woke up and little boy woke up. And then the fight was on.
After attacking Dolores, the killer turned his attention to Carol.
I think Carol fought him pretty good. And then obviously she lost.
The 56-year-old had been overpowered by her attacker.
It appeared that she was sexually assaulted based on the way she was positioned on the floor. You can tell that she was beat to death.
But probably the most haunting moment for detectives was when they discovered the body of 5-year-old Christopher, just a few feet away from his grandmother.
Chris was found on a bed. He was struck. And he had a stuffed animal with him.
The horrifying triple homicide baffled police.
It didn't make any sense. Why are they dead?
And what puzzled the detective the most was the fact that two of the victims, Carol and Christopher, were from out of town. They had come to visit Carol's mother, Dolores, who was recently widowed, and in the midst of packing her belongings to move into a retirement home.
You have great-grandma, who's a local resident. You have grandma, who's from Tennessee, hasn't been there that long to make any enemies. And you have a little boy who really has no enemies. You know, why kill all three?
Hagen's instincts led him to believe that a burglar was behind the killings.
I think his plan, it was disrupted, causing a lot of frustration. Then he lost it and killed them all.
As investigators searched for answers, family members were informed of the terrible tragedy. Christopher's mother, Leah Abercrombie, had been looking forward to seeing her son the next day. The five-year-old had been visiting with relatives while she and her husband, John, settled into their new home in North Carolina. She vividly remembers the phone call that would forever change their lives. Leah Abercrombie.
An operator broke in and said there was an emergent call that I needed to take. And it was my sister-in-law. She ended up telling me that, Christopher, Carol, and Dolores had all been murdered. I couldn't even, wrap my head around it.
Leah couldn't even speak. She asked the neighbor to call her husband and to tell him he needed to come home immediately. She faced the heartbreaking task of telling him the devastating news.
How do you tell your husband, that his 5.5-year-old little boy and his mother and his grandmother had all just passed away? It was probably the hardest thing besides, I would say, burying my son. It's the hardest thing I've ever had to do.
John Abercrombie was a resident at the local hospital and was in the middle of a 12-hour shift when he was told there was an emergency.
I got home, and that's when my wife told me. She couldn't get it out. Did something happen to Christopher? Yes. Is he hurt? It's worse. Then it just kept piling on. You think the worst things happen, your son's dead, and now you're here, your mother and your grandmother too.
It was crushing news for the young doctor. His family had been destroyed in an instant.
I think, there's that numb, shocking feeling. You wake up in the morning, you think, it was a dream, and then immediately that hollow inside feeling's there again because you realize what's happened. And reality kind of just slowly sets in.
John Abercrombie and his wife, Leah, were inconsolable. Their only son, Christopher, had been the center of their world.
What's your name?
Christopher.
Christopher what?
Christopher Abercrombie.
Right. Hi.
They still couldn't understand how a visit to his great-grandmother's house had gone so terribly wrong.
He was within a day or so of coming home. We had been to the store getting special things for him just to kind of welcome him home. So I think we were just full of excitement.
It was just a sweet conversation, and we said goodnight, and I can't wait to see you. You're almost home. And then just hours later, he was gone.
Our first thing was, okay, we got to get to Kansas now.
The Abercrombies boarded a plane for the painful trip to Salina, along with John's father, Everett.
My dad was upset and he was in total disbelief.
The attack had robbed him of his wife of 36 years.
She was such a caring person. She was the glue to our family. She was a good lady, believed in church, believed in God, taught people how to read, worked as a librarian, worked as a teacher. So she was a people person.
The somber trip to Salina gave the family time to reflect on what had happened.
seen three generations basically wiped out just like that. I mean, that was a bitter pill to swallow for sure. At that point, I think you start trying to make sense of it. You know, why did this happen? Who would do something like this? You know, this just doesn't make sense.
On the Case, the podcast will continue in a moment. Quince is all about elevated essentials that feel effortless. Designed for layering and mixing, each piece helps build a timeless wardrobe. Beautiful staples that are made to last. With versatile silhouettes and thoughtful details, they're the kind of styles you wear again and again. Everything is high quality at a price that actually makes sense. I really love my cashmere sweater. It's warm and cozy during these winter months. Quince works directly with safe, ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're not paying for brand markup, just high-quality clothing. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Go to quince.com/OTCpod for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/OTCpod to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/OTCpod. While the Abercrombies were traveling to Kansas to bring their loved ones home, Celina investigators were working hard to track down the person responsible for the gruesome murders. They studied the crime scene and quickly found several clues. Special Agent Ronald Hagen.
When we walked in through the garage, first thing we saw was there's a print of a shoe.
The footprint, discovered on a dusty trunk, was located underneath an open window in the garage. It appeared to be the killer's point of entry. The clue supported the initial theory that the crime started as an attempted burglary.
There wasn't much evidence. It appeared we may have had a burglar because Dolores' vehicle was missing. It was an Oldsmobile.
Both Dolores and Carol's purses had also been stolen. On the surface, it looked like a burglary gone bad. But upon further consideration, Detective Hagen began having doubts.
Burglars don't kill like that. Sometimes a burglar will go in there and be confronted by somebody, but we rarely see three people being killed because of it. Most time they would retreat and just get out of there.
Police discovered evidence that the intruder had carefully planned the attack.
The phone wires were cut. And also the light was twisted, so it was off. I think he had gloves because we took the bulb to see if there was fingerprints on it. There wasn't anything. There was no prints really in the house. There was nothing. He didn't leave anything there. I think he'd been there before. He surveilled the house. He watched what was going on. He had an idea what he was going to do.
The coroner's report provided some key information about the weapon that had been used in the attack. Assistant County Attorney Tom Stanton.
We had specific tool marks, which indicated how the victims were bludgeoned and what type of instrument. We spent a long time discussing and looking for different types of tools that might fit the pattern that was discovered in the autopsies.
As the detectives continued to put together a theory of the crime, John's Aunt Kathy was able to provide them with a critical piece of information. She said that her late father had been meticulous about organizing his tools, and now one was obviously missing. Kathy Melander.
We went through my dad's shop and I knew right away that there was a wrench missing.
Police determined that the missing wrench had been used to commit the crime.
The murder weapon was from the home. It turned out to be a pipe wrench that had been in the garage.
It was another clue that the killer was familiar with the home. Investigators now wondered if the motive for the triple homicide was personal, committed by someone who had a grudge against John or his family. When the Abercrombies arrived in Kansas, John's first painful task was to identify the bodies of his loved ones. Lieutenant Sean Morton.
It was horrible for them. It was horrible to be there the day that we sat down with them and gave them as much information as we could at that point, and to witness, you know, their grief. It was tough.
The couple asked to be taken to the crime scene. John managed to gain the strength to visit the site of the triple murder.
I think I wanted questions answered, and that seemed the most logical way to do it. I needed to see things, what's going on here, rather than just telling me.
John and Leah believed that they owed it to Christopher to learn as much as they could about his final hours. They walked through Dolores' home, trying to decipher what could have happened that led to their real-life nightmare.
We didn't know how he died. There were lots of questions. I wanted to know. I had to know.
I love Bobby about this much.
Good.
Leah Abercrombie.
As a parent, you want to know. And you don't care how much you hurt or how sad you are. You feel like that's the last thing I have left to offer my child, was to go be with where he left this world.
It was then that the magnitude of the tragedy settled in on them.
We had to visit the place where he actually died. We just sat and just prayed and cried, you know, where we thought he'd actually lost his life.
Daddy, did you see that?
I sure did. That was incredible.
The couple searched for mementos of Christopher.
I was there too for, you know, anything that I could preserve that was still in the house that was his. I mean, even, you know, we're looking at the toothbrushes and we're finding dirty clothes. You know, as a mom, you're just looking for anything that he had just worn or touched or used in those days just before.
But as they walked through the house collecting their son's belongings, they were haunted by the feeling of the killer's presence. John Abercrombie.
It was pretty eerie, you know, walking the path that a killer took. And I don't know how to explain it. It's just such a deliberate path to the back of the house that I would not have pictured someone coming in to rob or steal would end up going to the back to kill somebody.
The nature of the crime was unthinkable. And as the news of the murder spread throughout Salina, the tight-knit community was rocked to its core. Lieutenant Scott Simpson.
There was a sense of fear in Salina. This was in an affluent neighborhood that things just don't happen like that there. We just don't see that type of crime. So we had our neighbors in the area were very on end, as well as the whole city.
While detectives tried to figure out why someone had taken the lives of three defenseless victims, an APB was put out to find Dolores' missing car. Officer Randy Jennings.
It was a Sunday afternoon, and there was a tone on the scanner, police scanner, from the Highway Patrol. It was an attempt to locate a stolen vehicle involved in a triple homicide in Salina. Well, that got my attention, and one of the first things I thought was, we need to get this on the air right away. Triple homicide in Salina just doesn't happen, period. It just never happens.
The intense search led to a break in the case. A deputy had located Dolores' stolen car, and police hoped it would contain the evidence needed to bring a sadistic killer to justice. The Oldsmobile had been abandoned in the parking lot of a nearby apartment complex. Detectives thought it was odd that the stolen car was discovered less than a mile from the crime scene.
Special Agent Ronald Hagen.
My first thoughts were the killer lives in the apartment complex. Got drunk, got stupid, did the bad thing, and took the car and drove it back home.
While police officers went door to door questioning everyone who lived in the area, forensic experts swept the car for clues. The search gave detectives an important lead. The killer had left Dolores and Carol's stolen purses behind, but had taken their credit cards. Investigators contacted the bank, hoping to find a paper trail.
Lieutenant Scott Simpson.
We were able to track the credit cards down. It had been used at one of the truck stops, attempt to get cash out. It had also been used at a quick shop to obtain gasoline at the pumps.
Detectives raced to the convenience store where the gas had been purchased. They carefully checked the video captured by the station's surveillance cameras, but they were unable to see the suspect's face. Investigators hope for better luck when they reviewed the footage at the truck stop's ATM. Perhaps it had caught the suspect making a withdrawal using Carol's card.
There was a video machine, and they seized the tape and had it developed so we could see who was on the tape.
Remarkably, it appeared that the killer had been caught on camera.
It was a male, a very relatively large male, and that was it. The quality of the tape wasn't very good.
It was very grainy. You could tell an individual was attempting to use the credit card in the ATM machine, but it wasn't really clear enough to give an indication of who that might be.
Police talked to everyone they could find who had been at the truck stop that night, but no one could remember the mysterious man in the surveillance video. It was a frustrating setback.
There's some four-letter words that come out of me once in a while when things aren't going well.
Investigators played the video over and over again for the victim's family, hoping that they might recognize something. John Abercrombie realized that he may be looking at the perpetrator who had destroyed his family.
It was short and it was pretty dark. But, you know, you're looking at a monster, so it hits you. You know, that's probably the guy that did it.
Unfortunately, he wasn't able to identify the man caught on tape.
You get letdowns like that, quite a few throughout all that process. Definitely a letdown.
But just as one promising lead failed to pan out, detectives learned that the medical examiner had discovered an even more important one.
Our lab did the autopsies, took samples from Carol that had DNA on it, and it wasn't hers.
The coroner had been able to gather enough biological evidence to develop a profile of her killer.
The idea was to match that up with somebody.
But who? Investigators still believe that the killer was someone who had known one or all of his victims. At the funeral for 80-year-old Dolores McKim, police set up surveillance cameras at the service to observe everyone in attendance.
Assistant County Attorney Tom Stanton.
There was a plan to videotape the funeral. And the reason for that is it appeared that somebody was very familiar with the house. It could be someone close to the family who then might actually show up to the funeral.
We had officers in different parts of the area taking pictures of people going in, people going out. We had people inside watching, seeing if there's any reaction to when they would see the caskets and things of that nature, or interaction with the family.
Investigators were hoping that the funeral would yield new clues.
Somebody who knew these people, and if they killed them, they would probably show up. We've had that happen in the past.
The church was crowded as Dolores' loved ones came to pay their respects. Brent Melander a family member was one of the many attending the funeral. The off-duty deputy wasn't working the case, but he noticed something the other officers had missed.
As I was walking down the hallway, this person by the name of Alan White turned the corner and walked right past me, and I knew Alan White from the Saline County Jail. He'd been an inmate there on several occasions.
As Melander got closer, it dawned on him just how out of place White seemed at the service.
I started thinking, well, why would he be here? We made eye contact, and I said hello, and he responded back, and it was just the look in his face, in his eyes, just kind of that hollow appearance. The bell started ringing, and I thought, something's not right.
The officer's gut reaction told him that something about Alan White seemed suspicious.
It was just the glance that he gave me, the eye contact. There was just something as you looked into his eyes, at his face.
Brent shared his observations with investigators, who took a look at White's behavior for themselves. The footage showed Alan White entering the church alone. He appeared uncomfortable, constantly looking around to see if he was being noticed. Then, he abruptly left the service. Police analyzed White's demeanor.
They had the same opinion as I did when he came walking out of the funeral. Just the look on his face was just totally, totally out there.
White's demeanor and presence at the funeral raised red flags.
Why is he there? As far as we know, he didn't know these people. We need to go visit with this guy. Find out what's going on. And that's what we did.
We are back on the case after this. Brent Melander's chance encounter with Alan White at the funeral was about to send the triple homicide investigation into a totally new direction. He took it upon himself to see if there was a connection between 27-year-old Alan White and Dolores McKim's family. Brent Melander.
I discovered that Alan White's parents were good friends with Jim and Dolores, so I thought, well, maybe that was why he was at the funeral.
While Melander's discovery about White's connection to the family lessened his concerns, it only served to heighten investigators' suspicions. They believed that the killer had known his victims and had cased Dolores' home before the attack.
Special Agent Ronald Hagen.
That connection gave me the idea that he knew where the house was.
And when Hagen dug deeper, he continued to find details that tied White to the crime. The 27-year-old had been inside the McKim's home.
His dad knew Dolores' husband because they were in ham operators together. And then Alan had some interest in it, so Alan had come with his dad.
The detective was able to establish that Alan White visited Dolores' home on more than one occasion.
He knew the layout of the house, and he knew the people that belonged in the house. So that caused me some concern.
And Special Agent Hagen's concern grew when he ran White's name through the police database. A routine background check brought to light some chilling information.
He was a burglar. That was his claim to fame.
Special Agent Hagen now had enough circumstantial evidence to view Alan White as a person of interest in the triple homicide. Police quickly tracked him down. During a scheduled meeting with his probation officer, they asked White where he had been on the night of the murders.
Alan told him that he was staying in Formosa and that he was not in Salina during that weekend.
White acknowledged knowing the McKim family, but he denied any involvement in the murders.
Kathy Melander.
They asked him if he disliked the family. He said, oh no, they were always wonderful to me.
At the end of that conversation, police believed it was possible that White was telling the truth. But they still had enough doubts to double-check his alibi. And in that process, they discovered a pawn shop in Salina that had a record of White being in the store within hours of the triple homicide.
Basically, Alan lied, pawned some stuff, and Alan was in the area.
Investigators knew they needed to have another talk with White. But when police went to confront him with what they had uncovered, White had disappeared.
Lieutenant Scott Simpson.
He did not show up for his probation meeting with the probation officer. And we tried to locate him at his residence. We had found out that he had left.
And no one knew where he had gone. Police believe there was only one reason why White had skipped town.
He apparently knew we were looking for something more so, and he took off.
Salina homicide detectives informed John and Leah Abercrombie that they had identified a prime suspect.
John Abercrombie.
That was huge. We have a great lead. Now they just got to go catch him.
Alan White was on the run, and authorities began to put the pieces in place to track him down.
We got a fugitive warrant. We visited with the U.S. Marshal Service, and they helped us set what we needed to do to get that. We notified the FBI.
He was entered into NCIC as a wanted person for that failure to appear. His vehicle, along with tag number, was entered into the system as well.
The move paid off. Shortly after placing White's information into the national database, investigators were notified that his pickup truck had been found abandoned in Nebraska.
Lincoln Police Department of Nebraska found it by an Amtrak station.
The discovery of White's truck at a train station confirmed everyone's worst fears.
The trail kind of went cold. Now we know he could be anywhere pretty much in America.
But 1 month after finding White's truck in Nebraska, police picked up his trail in Cleveland, Ohio, after his ID tripped an alert in a government computer.
He applied for benefits, and his name popped up because we had a fugitive warrant for him. Cleveland police were notified to see if they could find him. But he was gone by the time they got there.
Once again, White had managed to elude capture. Investigators decided to talk with Alan White's parents, hoping that they might be able to help them find their son.
We visited with the parents and explained to him that he is on the run.
Police laid out the circumstantial evidence they had compiled connecting the couple's son to the gruesome triple murder. They also mentioned that they had hoped to get a sample of the 27-year-old's DNA before he had fled. White's mother and father desperately clung to the hope that their son had nothing to do with the crime. They asked Special Agent Hagen what they could do to help the investigation.
We did have some DNA evidence, and so we explained that if you'd like to give me your blood, both parents, I can take it back to our lab, and they will compare with what we have. And they agreed to do that.
The nationwide manhunt for Alan White, the 27-year-old accused of committing one of the worst crimes in the history of Salina, Kansas, dragged on. As the weeks passed, and the prime suspect had somehow managed to elude authorities, John and Leah Abercrombie faced a painful possibility. What if their son's killer was never caught and brought to justice?
Leah Abercrombie.
Once he was on the run, we thought he was gone and off to do it again.
Detectives had tracked down White in Ohio, but the fugitive had vanished before they could arrest him. White had simply disappeared, and authorities had nothing to indicate where he might have gone.
We had nothing. It was just dried up.
While the hunt for White continued, police were also working hard to solidify the case against him. The results of the DNA test had returned.
We got the DNA from Mom and Dad, and we had it shipped up to the KBI lab, and they matched up the genetics saying it's a male offspring. He was the only son they had.
There was a DNA match to Alan White, and that was huge. That was a big piece of the puzzle that we were looking for. We all had our theories before of what might have happened, but at that point, Alan White is our man. We were able to obtain an arrest warrant for him.
Police were now certain that White had committed the barbaric murders. The pressure to bring him to justice before he could kill again forced police to think outside of the box. They decided to take the investigation public.
We were kind of brainstorming and came up with using America's Most Wanted. And so I thought, why not? We have nothing else going on.
None of the detectives believed the plan would succeed. But when the show was broadcast nationwide, the act of desperation quickly paid off.
They profiled Alan. Within 15 minutes, there was a phone call that came in from Boston.
The woman on the line had recognized White's picture.
A lady that has a homeless shelter says Alan is there. She knows him. He's there now.
Hagen contacted Boston police, who immediately dispatched officers to the location where White had been hiding.
Half hour, maybe a little bit more, calls back. He says, we have him. What do you want to do with him?
Detective Hagen was stunned.
I was like, this is great. Let's go talk with him.
Kansas police called John and Leah with the news that Alan White was in custody.
He said in a very excited, warm voice, John, we got him.
We were so floored that it really worked.
It was a proud moment for the Salina investigators who had worked tirelessly to put a ruthless killer in handcuffs.
Lieutenant Sean Morton.
I was so happy to be able to give that information to them, especially since I was there when the information was given to them that their loved ones had been killed.
Ron Hagen flew to Boston to question Alan White. He was finally face to face with the man he believed had committed the heinous triple homicide.
Told him why he was there. Said, you know, we're holding you for a warrant on this. Was there something you'd like to talk to us about regarding these murders? And Alan said, I think I need an attorney. I said, Alan, I think you're right. I think you need an attorney.
John and Leah also made the trip to Boston. They were determined to confront the man they were convinced murdered their family.
He was in custody, and we immediately knew that we had to fly wherever he was and lay our eyes on him.
I don't know what our expectations were, but we wanted to see who could do something like this.
An odd stroke of fate brought the couple within feet of Alan White as he was transported to a Boston jail. John kept his distance, afraid of what he might do.
That was hard. It was pure fire and anger for me. I stood across the street for that reason.
But his wife, Leah, was filled with rage and continued to inch closer. She found herself only yards away from the monster who she believed had shattered her family.
I wanted him dead. You're so stunned that this person really exists and is right in front of you.
Leah admits that she considered taking the law into her own hands by killing White on the spot.
He took our family, and why should he still be allowed to live?
4 months after the Abercrombie's world was shattered, Alan White was charged with capital murder and extradited to Salina, Kansas.
Lieutenant Scott Simpson.
It was just a big relief to know that that portion of the investigation is done. We do have our man. He's arrested. He's in custody. And now we can concentrate on prosecution.
The county attorney's office was prepared to put White on trial for his life.
Assistant County Attorney Tom Stanton.
The age of Christopher, the 5-year-old, the fact there was a rape involved, the fact that this was done in a particularly brutal and heinous manner, those were some of the things that we were arguing should result in death penalty.
Alan White and his defense team knew that the evidence against him was overwhelming, and they offered to plead guilty to all of the charges if the death penalty was waived. The prosecutor turned to the Abercrombies for their reaction.
He was going to plead guilty to capital murder. He would give us a confession. And if at any time in the future he filed an appeal, we would be able to use this confession against him.
For John and Leah, it was an agonizing choice. They were deeply conflicted over letting White accept a plea deal that would take the death penalty off the table.
I would love to have seen him put to death.
I felt like in some way going to prison was an easy way out.
In the end, the couple was able to accept the plea deal, which spared White's life. As part of the plea deal, White gave police all of the horrifying details of the triple homicide. In a videotape confession that provided his initial motive for the disturbing killing spree.
He told investigators that his intent was to rape Dolores. And that's what he came to do. He didn't anticipate the other people being there.
He admitted to breaking into the house. He admitted to using the pipe wrench. He admitted to murdering them, and it was basically for his own personal gratification.
When he was done, grabbed a soda out of the refrigerator, took the car, and drove away.
The Abercrombies were sickened.
I think that's one thing that still bothers me. For him to say he went in just to rape and murder, it's just unbelievable that somebody would have that motive.
Really disgusting. I mean, that's such a slap in the face.
To this day, Christopher's parents remain haunted by questions that may never be answered.
One thing I would love to know is, did he know that Christopher and Carol were there? And I still don't know that. I don't know that it would, you know, change anything. It'd be really nice to think that he didn't know. But I also think he could have cared less.
During the sentencing hearing, John and Leah were given the opportunity to face the man who had so brutally taken the life of John's grandmother, his mother, and their only son, Christopher. They bravely made their victim's impact statements to the court.
I wanted to communicate my anger towards him, what he'd put our family through. I wanted to see some emotion out of him, because I didn't want to believe that there is somebody out there without any emotion, no remorse, just cold-blooded killer.
The dramatic statement impacted everyone in the courtroom, except for Alan White. Lieutenant Sean Morton.
One of the things that I won't forget is John, he talked about that they had always told Christopher that there were no monsters and that he was wrong. Alan White was a monster.
White never addressed the family he had destroyed.
He did not once show any sign of remorse, let alone emotion. It was a pretty cold stare.
He never broke down, never cried, didn't do anything like that that would indicate that he understood the gravity of what he had done.
In 1998, nearly 2 years after the murders, Alan White was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
He's sick. He's not insane. He knew what he was doing. He knew why he was doing. And somewhere in his mind justified what he did. He needed to go away. He's an evil guy. And if we wouldn't have stopped him, we wouldn't have caught him, he probably would have done it again.
Detective Hagen still reflects back on the case. And one vivid image haunts his memory.
Christopher. That's pretty much it.
After White's conviction, John and Leah Abercrombie finally had a chance to try to rebuild their lives. And they have found a way to move forward, thanks to counseling, the support of their family, and most importantly, the two loving sons they had after the tragedy.
They know they've had a brother that died, and a bad man came in the house and killed him, Grandma Carol and my Grandma Dee.
In fact, it was one of Christopher's brothers who encouraged John and Leah to share their experience with the world.
He's the one that said, you know, to my wife, if this is going to help just one person, it's worth you doing it. Statistically, not many marriages survive the death of a child. We want people to know that you can make it. You can get through this. There's a way.
Every day you think about it, I mean, it never goes away. You just learn how to deal with it better.
The Abercrombies were touched to learn that the Salina community had come together to create Chris's Place. The nonprofit outreach center was named in honor of their son, Christopher, and its purpose is to offer help to children in need. Thanks for listening. Please don't forget to follow, rate, and review. And if you want more information on today's case, visit facebook.com/paulazanofficial or just click the link in the episode description. I'm Paula Zahn. Please join us again next Wednesday when we're back on the case, the podcast.